Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. It's Travis, and today I want to talk about who will get stuck in the trap of 30-year income-driven repayment. So 30-year IDR is going to be the new repayment term for the RAP plan, Repayment Assistance Plan. That's going to be the only income-driven option for people starting in July 2026, for anybody taking out a new loan after July 2026. So now that hasn't already started taking out loans before that date for a program that they've already enrolled in before that date. So that's the only caveat I'd throw out on that. So who will get stuck in this 30-year repayment term? It's not actually just people that are new borrowers as of 2026. There's a way to get stuck in it even if you're an existing borrower. So I thought I would call that out for a second. So if you have not switched to the IBR repayment plan before the date that they're going to start switching people over by, it's technically, I believe, 2028, mid-2028. If you haven't made the selection to change to IBR by that date, they can sweep you from whatever ICR-related plan you're on, including the pay plan, and they can swap you into the RAP plan, which is 30 years instead of 20 years or 25. So that's really concerning. So if you're going to stay in an ICR type of plan, including the save forbearance, the pay plan, the ICR plan itself, you have to know that one of the tricks in this bill that they passed could move you into the RAP plan if you don't change to the IBR plan before this mid-2028 date. That's a little bit of a scary thing. There's also another scary thing of folks who are going to be taking out Parent PLUS loans after July 2026. So some folks already have kids in school, they're grandfathered in, they're able to borrow more loans for Parent PLUS, except they're not going to have any access to income-driven repayment after July 2026 at all, unless you've already consolidated before that date. So folks that applies to, those folks are going to be out of luck because they're going to have no affordable income-driven option to pay back their loans, and they're going to be stuck with, you know, really large loan amounts and have no option but to default in a lot of cases. So that's concerning. The other thing that's a little concerning that I think about when I think about this RAP plan, folks, I've run the math, and folks who are taking out the maximum on RAP, which is 200 grand, you know, once this new date goes into effect and you're a new borrower as of July 2026, if you take out the 200 grand, I've run the math, and it looks like you can really only go for forgiveness in the private sector with a 30-year repayment plan if your debt-to-income ratio is more than 2-to-1. And what that means is if you have $200,000 of loans, that means you're making less than $100,000 a year. If you are making more than $100,000 a year with $200,000 of debt, it is extremely difficult to get forgiveness in the private sector with the $200,000 loan limit. In fact, it's virtually impossible. I shouldn't say impossible, because theoretically you could max out your 401k, you could file taxes separately, you know, you maybe you could put your max in your HSA as well. So maybe it's not impossible, but it becomes very, very difficult. And this is for people that have that new loan limit that applies to them. If you have that new loan limit that applies, that's a little bit of a different situation because you're having no choice in a lot of cases but to pay it back. But folks who have the higher loan amounts that they're taking out, the higher loan amounts that you're eligible to take out are only the case after 2026 if you are already enrolled in a program that you borrowed for as of July 2026. For example, let's say you started dental school this fall, and you have three more years to go, and your second year starts the fall of 2026. Well, you'd be able to finish out your dental school with the full Grad PLUS loan amounts. So if you're at, you know, NYU Dental, you're taking out the full 700 grand. You're taking out that 700 grand in 2026 to 2027 academic year, 27 to 28 academic year, and 28 to 29 academic year. So you're going to come out with that 700K of loans. But the problem is because you took out loans after July 2026, the only repayment option you would have on most of your debt would be the RAP plan. What's going to happen is people are going to be making $200,000 a year with $700,000 of loans. And even though their payments are going to be substantial and they're going to be in repayment for 30 years, they'll still be better off going for forgiveness with this really bizarre situation of the people who are graduating in this 2026 to 2029 timeframe that were, you know, that started borrowing before the deadline of July 2026. So for those folks, the 30-year repayment option, I will predict that it's not going to remain a 30-year repayment option, just to be honest. The reason I'll say that is it's almost certain the Democrats will have unified control of Congress and the White House at some point in the next 30 years. Just statistically, that happens for either party at various times, and I would be shocked if there's not unified Democratic control or if the Democratic Party somehow is no more and there's like a progressive party or something like that, whatever the center-left party is would have unified control at least once in the next 30 years. I think it's highly likely, you know, it would be the Democratic Party and not some new party. I think they're going to regain power at some point, of course, you know, in particular when the next recession happens. That often is when, you know, the party in power gets kicked out, right? So let's say Democrats take unified control and they have Congress and the White House. What will they do with budget reconciliation and student loans? They're going to be at least as aggressive as the Republicans are, have been on student loans. Why? Because education is now one of the key dividing lines between the two parties' coalitions. When I started doing this in 2016, it was pretty much the case that you could expect a lot of, you know, highly educated professionals in the suburbs that maybe were a little bit more moderate or progressive on social issues, but economically they were more conservative, and a lot of them voted for Republicans. And then, of course, you also had highly educated academics that, you know, have always more leaned towards more of the progressive side, and those tended to vote more Democratic. But you didn't have the extreme split in the white working class as much before 2016, right? You had a lot of people in the white working class that voted Democratic, a lot of people that voted Republican. And then what sort of happened, right, during the sort of Trump era is you've got all these sort of white working class voters that have gravitated towards the Republican Party that don't prioritize things like student loan cancellation or forgiveness. You have highly educated voters, especially a lot of those in the suburbs with advanced degrees that have gravitated towards the Democratic Party. And those folks do care a lot about, you know, forgiveness and student loan policy. And so what's really happened is you've seen the Democratic Party become the party of student loan forgiveness and cancellation, and the Republican Party become the party who's against it. Do I think that dynamic's going to change? No, I don't. I think it's going to stay in place. And the next time Democrats have unified control, at a minimum, I would expect they would try to reintroduce something like the SAVE plan, which again was 225% of the poverty line and 20 years still forgiveness for undergrad and 25 for grad. I think they maybe could go bigger than that. In a reconciliation bill, if they wanted to, they could do 300% of the poverty line, right, if they felt like it. So people who are taking on all this debt, they're going to get stuck in 30-year RAP plan. I would not be despondent. I would think that what you need to do is just look at the math and say, if forgiveness makes sense with a 30-year plan, if there's ever something that changes in Congress, it's going to make even more sense to go for forgiveness. At the same time, I would probably not use that thinking on somebody who, you know, takes out $200,000 or less of loans under the new loan limits that needs to decide, do I pay back my loans with the RAP plan through forgiveness, or do I just try to pay them off? One caveat I'll say is anybody who's eligible for public service loan forgiveness should probably go for that, even under the new regime. And the reason is you can pretty much get low to $0 payments almost universally in the first 2 years after graduation if you know how to file your tax return intelligently in terms of when you would file it, right? And when you would use your prior tax return to certify your IDR payment. So if you do it smart, then you could effectively gain 2 of the 10 years of low to $0 payments, and then you have 8 more years to go. Well, even if your payments are capped at the standard 10-year plan for those 8 full years because you're making way more than your debt, you'd still have a modest amount to forgive at the end of the 10th year under PSLF because they're making it so that you can access IBR even without a partial financial hardship. You're just going to be able to pay the standard 10-year amount on the loan amount. So that's if you have a very high income relative to your debt. Now, if you have a high debt relative to income, obviously PSLF makes even more sense. But I think that what's going to happen is most people under PSLF are going to go for it still, even after the new loan limits go into place. And then the folks who are private sector are going to have a real hard time going for forgiveness unless you're earning 5 figures and you have $200,000 of loans. I think that's the one exception, really. Besides the folks, of course, that are taking out the existing loan limits that are going to be really, really large loans from 2026 to 2029 that will still be eligible for the new income-based repayment plan. This is obviously still a mess. I've talked to some financial aid folks out there, and a lot of the schools right now are completely just not knowing what to do, not knowing what's going to happen. There's so much uncertainty right now. Everybody is just completely just doesn't know what's going on. And the reason is because a lot of these, you know, the law that passed, a lot of the regulations have not really been put out. So everybody's a little bit in the dark as to how some of this is going to be interpreted. Department of Ed is supposed to shut down, right? According to the White House, it's supposed to shut down and be transferred to some other department. Well, who the heck's going to run all these programs? Who the heck's going to run the FAFSA? Who the heck's going to run all this new regulation that needs to be written and then, you know, explain to colleges and how they do this. So, you know, who's going to administer the Higher Education Act? I mean, there's all kinds of questions that the schools are just not getting answered right now. And the only reason why this fall is not chaos is because none of the rules have changed yet. All the existing rules are pretty much the exact same. All the loan limits, all the ways things are done in the grad school and professional school market, it's all the same, which means that the really crazy, scary, different thing that's going to happen is next fall of 2026. And what are people going to do? Well, let's think about the timeline. People are already starting to think about applying to their preferred professional and graduate schools now for next year. You probably get all the applications in December. People kind of make their decisions in January or February. The schools make, you know, application offers. And then, you know, people figure out, how do I finance this in like May and June? So if you think about, and some people even think about it a little bit before then. So if you think about maybe, let's say, April is when people start thinking about it. We're in September now. What is that, like 9-ish months until we have utter chaos in the grad and professional school market? I've talked about this before on this pod. Think about the number of pharmacy schools that existed in 2004. I believe it was about 43. I'm not looking it up right now. It's roughly that number in the low to mid 40s. And then within a couple years of Grad Plus being introduced, it was at 79 schools, I believe, something along those lines. And then a few years after that, it's at 120 to 130 schools. So you went from 40 schools to 120 something schools. Why? Because you told schools, hey, you can tell students they can borrow anything. No underwriting, no tests of what your degree value is, nothing. Take anything you want. So suddenly, every university that could or thought about it opened up a pharmacy school because they figured, why not? Right? We can hire people, we can grow, we can get more revenues, we can build more buildings, right? Like, you know, that's kind of the incentive for universities. How big can I get? What new programs and schools can I launch to make more money to subsidize my other programs that are not as profitable? I need to make more profit margin. How do I do that? Oh, look, they're giving out as much money as anybody wants for pharmacy school, PT school, vet school, dental school, et cetera, right? The only restriction on the number of schools that opened in grad and professional school programs is the job market, and then also things like residency slots that are funded by Medicare, which, you know, weren't affected by the change in Grad Plus. So any kind of limitations on the job front did limit the number of schools. But what we really saw happen with most of these schools, right, is like private equity got involved in a lot of these professions, and they began to rely on very affordable, mass-produced new grads that they could use as their labor force for 2 to 5 years on average or whatever it is, get a ton of value out of them, and just scale like crazy. And that has been enabled in large part, like that one of the reasons why I think private equity has exploded in a lot of these professional fields is exactly because of a huge supply of professionals, right? Because private equity is able to take advantage of a big supply compared to the historical norms and then pay people less. And so when I think about restriction of loan limits, I just don't know what's going to happen. You know, I don't know if it's going to be like I've talked about in the prior episode. Is it going to be 50% of grad schools that close? Here's another thing I found out doing some more research this week. I actually missed this in the initial reading. The limit for professional school borrowing is 50K per year, 200K aggregate. But the limit for non-professional school grad programs and master's programs is 20,500. That's the Stafford loan limit currently, except you can access Grad Plus or everything above 20,500. So virtually every program out there for master's and grad programs that are any cost at all, or just tell students once they hit that 20,500 limit with Stafford, hey, just go borrow Grad Plus as much as you want. Well, when people are capped at 20,000, think about what that means. Living expenses are 20 to 25 for most people. So that means that you can borrow living expenses of the federal government. Hey, guess what? You can't borrow tuition at all, which means everyone's going to have to borrow for every graduate program that they would do. Professional school, 50K sounds like a lot, except living expenses are like 20 to 25. So you're capped out at like 20 to 25K. The only professional schools that I know that charge that are in-state heavily subsidized schools that are very competitive to get into. Every other professional school charges more pretty much. So if you think about that, it's not sustainable. The schools are going to be knives out fighting for students, trying to get people to enroll. And I think what's going to happen is you're going to see the importing of undergrad-like financial aid negotiations that are going to go to graduate and professional degree programs. that's probably what will happen, where you'll be able to negotiate aid offers, negotiate tuition discounts, and who knows what's going to happen. I mean, there's all these kinds of laws from 2008 era when private student loans were a little bit more, you know, normal in the market. They really kind of got killed off in 2008 in a lot of ways when, you know, the government nationalized the federal student loan program and made everything a direct loan. But there's all these laws from like the late 2000s that talk about all these things about private loans. Who the heck knows? I mean, like, if you're asking the private student loan market to become, you know, the way that most grad and professional students fund their education, the private student loan market's not ready for that. All the underwriting models are old and need to be dusted off, and I don't even know if they'll have the access to capital. I mean, we're talking about needing to borrow probably $10 to $15 billion a year, and the private student loan market for grad school, I think, is a few hundred million in issuance per year right now. So is the private student loan market going to lend and fund all these grad programs? I don't think so. I think that they're going to be pretty choosy as to who they'll fund, and that's going to cause a lot of programs to give out offers to people, and the students are going to try to go, and they're going to say, oops, I don't have any way to get money for this. And the schools are going to be scrambling. They're going to be talking to the private student loan companies. Some of the private student loan companies probably will expand their offering, but they're going to probably need very high interest rates to do so. So I think you're going to see, in some cases, double-digit interest rates for private student loans, because the alternative is people can't go. And a lot of people, I mean, even at 10%, in fact, a lot of these programs, even though I beat up on them sometimes in the podcast, there's still some of them actually good deals. I mean, some of them you can still get a decent payout even on a 10% private student loan. You know, if you're a, you know, I don't know if you use this, if this is a good example, but if you're a nurse and you become a nurse practitioner, that's pretty much going to work out unless you go to one of the most expensive programs in the country. Even if you have to pay back your loans and you don't get PSLF for some reason, it still generally works out. You know, if you become a dentist or a veterinarian compared to an undergrad degree, the only way that doesn't work out is if you go to a very high cost school and, you know, you work in a high cost of living city that has lots of competition, because a lot of people that are in your profession want to, you know, already are living there and competing with you in the labor market. So I think that the main thing to think about is, if you are borrowing, be aware of what the rules are. It's very important, more important than it's ever been, to be aware of what the rules are about when you can consolidate, when you should not consolidate, right? How much you'll be able to borrow over the next few years if you're still borrowing, and, you know, what you need to do prior to mid-2028 to be able to get onto the IBR plan if you need to. I think right now, I'll stick to pay, stick to the save forbearance if you're on it and don't want to do something otherwise. That said, most people in the safe parents, frankly, need to get into IBR and just get off of it. But, you know, we're still in this period where things are somewhat okay and calm, but we're coming to a spot pretty rapidly where things are going to be more chaotic. And again, April 2026 is, I think, the bullhorn is going to go off, that everybody's going to be freaking out, wondering what the heck do we do. And then for borrowers that have really pushed out recertification dates, I think folks need to be ready to recertify those much earlier than expected. We're already seeing the Department of Ed start wage garnishment again pretty soon. You know, I'm just thinking about folks that have 2027 recertification dates in some cases. I don't think the White House is going to honor that. I think that as soon as they get some clarity on the save lawsuit with the Eighth Circuit, that I don't even know if they'll ever rule on it, but if they do, once they have clarity, I think they're going to say, hey, income-based repayment is income-based repayment. We need to know what your income is. Give it to us now. And I think it could come with very little notice, maybe only a couple months worth of notice. So be paying attention to your tax filing strategy, be paying attention to when you file your taxes. All these things are going to matter more than ever because of just the environment that we're in. I know that things are stressful probably right now, but maybe in some ways it's a little bit calmer than usual in student loan world, because a lot of people are just sort of waiting around for something to happen. If you want to get a plan for what happens next, you know, obviously you can get a plan, studentloanplanner.com/book. And if you want to ask a question for the pod, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. We really appreciate you listening to this podcast. The reason I keep making it is because you listen. So thank you so much. And I hope you have a great rest of your week. Thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good, they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.